out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 22nd of November, 2018, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. We would normally be streaming this live, but we're actually pre-recording this today, but we do have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson with us anyway. Matt, how are you doing today?
Listen, if you hear cats fighting in the background, please forgive me. They're being very bad this morning, so please accept my apologies.
I'm sure
it's some kind of a turf war in my house. What the hell's going on? There are two boys. Get out here. So if you hear that, it's not, you know, it's not, it can't be helped.
Okay, never mind. Anyway, we've got a real special episode for listeners today, and this came about by somebody putting some messages in the chat room. He's actually a regular chat room member, Fielding Malish, and he's a regular listener to the Orthodox Nationalist. And like myself, he's not a university graduate, and he has some difficulty with understanding the terms. And he asked me what nominalism was. And I thought, well, I've listened to the whole 2-hour long podcast you did with Florian, but I still couldn't actually explain it to him. And then I thought, well, you know, most of the time when you listen to people speaking and there's a word that you don't understand, you can usually understand that word by all the other words that are being spoken around it. You can put the pieces of the puzzle together and you can see the big picture. But when it's philosophical language, it's not a language that we're used to conversing in. And it can be very difficult. I mean, sometimes I can go through a whole podcast of yours, Matt, without even properly working out what the meaning of the word is, because there are other words around it, which I also don't understand. So I thought what we could do today is maybe go through some of these words that people have put into the chat room, suggestions, and maybe do a bit of a glossary episode so that people can understand more your Orthodox Nationalist series, because I know there are a lot of listeners. You do have a lot of listeners for that series, and they're not all philosophy graduates, and we want to learn this stuff because it's fascinating. Do you want to add anything to that before I start throwing some of these words at you?
It's a very important idea. I should have done this myself. When you first mentioned it to me, I was skeptical, but now I realize how important it is. In any field, in any scientific field at all, it has its own vocabulary. And part of the definition of expertise is to master that vocabulary. And in philosophy, you have words that are used in a technical sense. That's the same word that you would use in ordinary conversation, but of course, it's defined totally different for us. So when you read a philosophy work or you hear us, I'm using a word that's in common use, but I'm using it in a technical sense. And if you don't know what that is, I can't make any sense. So this is a very good idea. In fact, I'm going to do my next Orthodox Nationalist on an expanded version of this, because there's so many of these. And I'm really happy for your listener and for you to have brought this up.
Okay, excellent. Well, let's start with the first one that he suggested then, and that was nominalism. So, I mean, how would you describe nominalism? How would you try to condense that down into an explanation that a layman could understand?
Nominalism, in my fight against it, is one of the hallmarks of my career. It's catching on now. It's the foundation of all modern errors. The simplest way I could define nominalism is the idea that there are no universal truths in existence. What we call universals, whether it be goodness or species like cat or dog or free will or anything like this, these really don't exist. They're just words in our minds. Every act of freedom is different, but for the sake of convenience, we abbreviate it and we use the word freedom to refer to them all. They don't have any inherent connection to each other. They just remind us of each other. And so we throw this label on. So the word nominalism comes from nominal or name. So it's just a word and nothing more than that. The implication is that there's no universal truths out there. There is no human nature. There's no reality in front of us. Everything is just convention and the way that we've just learned to describe things with no connection to the things themselves. It's just what we find useful. There's nothing real except the words that we use.
So you'd almost be saying, so if I was to say something that I find particularly disgusting in our society, and it's universally found disgusting everywhere, something, say, sodomy, for example, it's saying, well, no, that isn't. There is an instance where that could be good. So it's in effect saying there's no evil and there's no good either. There's just nothing. It's all what you make of it.
This is the only conclusion that any nominalist can come to. And, you know, I think anthropology as a discipline was founded to try to make the claim that there are no universal truths. There are no universal realities. And it turns out their attempt to do this has fallen flat miserably. There are things that are universally true, and universal facts. But even when they start talking about things like materialism or free will or dialectics, these are also universal. There's no human communication without universal. And to say that they don't correspond to anything real is to say that whoever controls language controls what you think reality is. So it gets very frightening over time. That's the implication of nominalism.
I think that's a really good example there, saying that there would be no communication without universals. I mean, that's just proof right there in your face that nominalism isn't correct. Well, you were talking about universals there. So how does universals differ from absolutes and absolutism?
Well, that's a key question. First of all, an absolute is something, a moral absolute, which is, I think, what you mean. A moral absolute is a fact that's true independent of time or place. Most people use examples like cowardice or laziness. Not only is there no record of that ever being promoted or rewarded, but as someone like Immanuel Kant would say, if those things ever were to be universalized, if they were to be made absolutes, you know, that in other words, laziness would be rewarded or something like that, society would collapse. You couldn't reward laziness or cowardice or thievery. You couldn't have a society then. It's immediately a contradiction. So that proves that these are, in fact, universal moral truths. And there's tremendous implications that comes from that, which is something that nominalists deny. And they try to argue against that in various ways. A universal may not necessarily be an absolute. An example of that is utilitarianism, the idea that human beings pursue pleasure and are repulsed by pain. The content of pleasure and pain may differ. So it's not an absolute, but it is a universal. Now, I reject utilitarianism. It's one of the worst forms of nominalism out there. But it is an example of a universal truth. It isn't an absolute truth, because you're talking only about the form rather than the content. Often, though, they're used synonymously, and most people aren't going to be upset if you use one for the other. So when I say universals, I'm referring to both definitions of the term. And nominalist, of course, is constantly at war with the idea that there's any such a thing. But it's more than just relativism. Remember that. Because it doesn't even say that these are acts that we could bring under one name. Any act of evil, for example, is different one from another. There is no essence of evil out there. There is no universal conception. We just call these things evil because we don't like them, or they hurt, or something like that, or some, you know, banal reason like that. And we stick a word on it. But that doesn't imply at all that they're, you know, these absolutes that exist beyond time and place. So these are absolutely essential concepts.
We used another word there that I know gets brought up a lot, essence. And obviously when we use the word essence in every day, we sort of say things like, well, You've got lemon essence, which is condensed lemon, basically, the essence, the flavor of the lemon. So how does that fit in to philosophy? What do you mean when you're talking about essence, when you're talking about an essence there?
Well, let's define the concepts of metaphysics and ontology first, because the concept of an essence or a substance or nature, which often mean the same thing, are aspects of metaphysics and ontology. First of all, ontology is a study of what exists. It's a study of being. And the main question is, what is real versus what's an illusion, or what's merely the report of our senses, a phenomenon, versus what's actually out there independent of whether we know it or whether we see it. Metaphysics is much bigger than that. Metaphysics is a much bigger field, which literally means that which is behind or beyond the physical world. In other words, the foundation from which the physical world comes. We see things as phenomena. We only see things as mental representation. We don't know if what we see exists at all. All we know is that we have a mental representation of things out there. Trying to prove whether you're dreaming or awake is impossible. There's simply no way to know. All we know is that our senses are telling us something. But in and of itself, that doesn't prove that it's actually there. All we know is that our senses are telling us it's there. These are the main questions of metaphysics. So there has to be a foundation that makes sense out of all of our perceptions. No, these are real because there's a foundation, usually a spiritual one, that guarantees the truth of these things. These are essential concepts of metaphysics and its subset, ontology. Now, ontology only deals with being, what is versus what is not, what exists and is what merely is an illusion or a delusion. So essence being one of the main aspects of this. An essence is a set of properties the object is. If you take any one of those properties away,
Hang on, Matt. You just went quiet there when you just sort of dropped out when you were just about to describe essence. So if you just go for that again, if you can.
It says poor network connection. Do you hear me?
Yeah. You're back again now.
Okay. All right. I went away. All right. Sorry about that.
Essence. If you begin with describing essence.
Essence is a set of properties that define an object. If you take any one of those properties away, you don't have the object anymore. The opposite of essence is accident. So you could define a cat, for example, as any fur-covered creature with four legs and that purrs. That's a set of properties that's the essence of a cat. But an accident would be what color it is or how big it is. Those wouldn't matter. It would still be a cat no matter what color it is. Any species like this, any aspect of the world that actually exists out there has an essence, and it defines what it is. But there's accidental aspects of this, color usually is a big one. Weight is often a big one. They don't add to or take away from the existence of something. This is one of the, goes back to Aristotle, and is one of the essential questions of both ontology and metaphysics. The idea of an essence is absolutely essential to our battle against degeneracy, because all degenerate ideologies reject the idea of essence at all. All there is a flux. This is at the root of Kabbalah, at the root of Nietzscheanism. All there is a flux, and the elite and the elite alone decide what's real, pinning down that flux, that energy, and making what we think are objects. And only the powerful, only the chosen people are allowed to do that. It's the will to power. When you take the concept of essence away, when you remove it, when you deny it, all you have left is the flux and our human will, the will to power. That's the only thing that are left. And so you have your drives, your instincts, whatever it is, you get the degeneracy of the modern West. And it comes from the denial of essence, the denial of universals, denial of absolutes, or sum it all up in nominalism. That's the best way to bring all of these together. And it's a philosophical approach to exactly what we do every day of our lives.
Well, I think I discovered my essence when I came across nationalism. And I discovered that I was all about this degeneracy, that I was really against this degeneracy. And a thought that came through my mind is, once you know what you are against, then you finally know what you are for. I didn't know what I was for until then. Once I knew what I was against, then I knew what my mission in life was to fight against that. And it wasn't until I really knew that I didn't really have a drive. And I think that's the essence of all white people, is to fight against this degeneracy. And unless you're doing that, then you're not really living in tune with what the essence of being a white man is.
Well, Aristotle defined human nature or a human essence, and we usually use those two words synonymously, as a being that possesses both reason and freedom. And you can't have one without the other. You can't be rational without being free. This doesn't make any sense. And you certainly can't be free without being rational. That's the essence of a human being. But that's just the formal expression of it. The material expression of it would be what you do with that. So you as a radio producer, myself as a scholar, a policeman, a soldier, those are very specific things that are done that are both reasonable and free, or contribute to both reason and freedom. But those are the content. Reason and freedom are the form. The content is our work. Like you say, this battle against degeneracy, this understanding of what the nation is. And, you know, I've defined in the past the nation, and I've coined the phrase structures of survival. Nations come into existence through suffering, through foreign occupation, through imperialism, through warfare. The people come to know who they are by hanging together as a family. How they do that is what we call tradition. So without suffering, you don't have an individual, you don't have a person, you don't have a family, you don't have a nation. You come to know what you are through your adjustments to this kind of suffering. This is how nations are born. This is the essence of what we call dialectics. You don't know what is until you are confronted by what isn't. You don't know what good is until you're at war with evil. This is how human beings learn. It's absolutely essential to the notion of both freedom and reason. So degenerate ideologies, by rejecting essence, liberate passion and instinct without any control, and what you get is insanity. Because these passions, whether lust or greed or anger, they're never satisfied. And without any control, people will kill each other. The most ridiculous thing that's ever happened is a sexual revolution in the West, where the man's sex drive, the most powerful forces in the world, were let loose. How can that possibly end well? And today, those drives are now criminalized. Isn't that nice? They liberate them a generation ago, then now they criminalize the results of that liberation today. This is the nature of degeneracy. This is what they do. They deny human nature. They promote degeneracy. Then they use it against us. Without essence, you have no civilization. You have no freedom. You have no reason. You have nothing but the will to power. And that's a disgusting way to live.
Okay, well, let's move on to some of the other words that I often hear you use. What about epistemology? What is epistemology?
Epistemology is, of course, connected with both metaphysics and ontology. And epistemology is the study of knowledge. More specifically, the study of how we come to know something, how we know we know something. What are the criteria we have to have in order to be able to say that I know something? It's a difference between knowledge and opinion. How do we know that something is known, which is the same thing as saying it's real? But how can we come to understand that? Those are basic epistemological questions. One answer to it would be empiricism. We only come to know something through the report of our senses. And when we get that the sense data, we organize it and categorize it into species and objects and things that we find useful. Empiricism, of course, leads to nominalism. It really is based on nominalism, because there is no truth to empiricism, because it's always changing. So that's one epistemological question. So it's connected with what is real and what isn't. But in this particular case, it's how we come to know what's real and what isn't.
That's like science, isn't it? Science is always changing. Everybody has a faith in science. They believe that what they've been told is accurate and true. And then another experiment will come along which changes that. And then everybody will believe in something else. And yet all along, people will keep having this faith in science, which is continually changing. Whereas with religion, you've got something that doesn't change, where the information comes from God and it is absolute and it is universal. And yet everybody puts their faith in science instead of in religion.
Well, the things that were scientific breakthroughs 100 years ago are laughed at today. The modern concept of positivism, which is the official ideology of the scientific method, which is based both on empiricism and nominalism, says, according to people like Karl Popper and many others, they say that scientific experiment can lead to certain truths, but they're always unstable. They're true only to the extent that another experiment hasn't come around to show that it's false. That's what truth is. So truth is always unstable. There really isn't any truth, because what you believe today may be wiped out tomorrow. And this is what the scientific method is, at least according to the positivists. And positivists have always been the dominant ideology in the scientific world. Now, this isn't, you know, science isn't about truth. It's as much about power as anything else. Science is always changing. And it really rejects its own conclusions every generation.
What about existentialism then? Because I keep hearing there's an existential threat to the Jews. And I always thought, well, existentialism, it's obviously got something to do with existence. Is it saying this is all there is existence? And how come this is now being used by journalists to describe Jews' apparent fear of anti-Semitism?
Well, I hear it all the time. Only really in the last couple of years have journalists and only journalists use the phrase existential threat, and the two words are used together. They really don't have a definition of what it is. It's just a threat that actually exists. It's really stupid. It's a pseudo-intellectual. It makes them sound smart. As a philosophical term, though, existentialism is the idea. Existentialism is what happens when you deny essence. This is what happens. This is what every nominalist has to become. An existentialist believes solely in human freedom, without truth, without knowledge, but with full responsibility for what you do. It's the first philosophical school based largely on anxiety, really anxiety and depression. Most existentialists are atheists, but that's not always the case. People like Kierkegaard and Buber, who is a Jew, aren't atheists, but generally speaking, the great Jean-Paul Sartre, was the great founder of the school, was a pure atheist. And the idea is that we are called on to make decisions all the time with great consequences without any real knowledge of what's right or wrong. The point of it is that we have to grasp that fact, and we have to, like Nietzsche would say, we have to actually live and own that fact. Nietzsche would say that there is no reality except the will to power. But only a handful of people are willing to take that responsibility to craft reality and then impose it on everybody else. That's the essence of Nietzscheanism. Most people are running from freedom. They're scared to death of freedom because they don't want to be held responsible to things. So the concept of existentialism then becomes authenticity. The idea that you can't blame people for errors, whether it be the subconscious, whether it be ideology, whether it be the crowd, someone made me, that's just, I was taking orders. I don't care what the excuse is. Those are not excuses. No excuses. There's actually a compilation of existential works called No Excuses. It's the core of it. You own the fact that you have to take responsibility for things. But Nietzsche took it a step further by saying, even before Sartre, by saying, no, we create reality. We force reality on people. And that's the standard that we create, but only the handful, the tiny elite, can do that. Of course, in the Kabbalah, they believe the exact same thing, except that the Jews are this elite. And in the Kabbalah, there is no God. It's just the flux, the Ein Sof. It's a nothing. It's this flow of nonstop, accidents, nothing but accidents, sounds, colors. Nothing seems to be real. Everything's unstable. We have to put a stop to that and create reality. Through language, through words. You see, all this stuff is connected. The existentialist is frightened because he doesn't really know. He exists in a world where everything's unstable, yet he still has to act. He still has to do things that have consequences that could last for generations. Stop making excuses for it. Take ownership of it. There is nothing out there. There is certainly no human nature. That's something that we have to create for ourselves. But only a handful of people are capable of doing that.
So this would tie in with denying that there's any racial heritage, denying that anything was inherited, that people are a blank slate at birth, that they are a tabula rasa, and that it's their right to take everything they can for the individual from the community, because everybody else is exactly the same. They're just going to be taking whatever they can from the community. It's the opposite of the sort of putting your nation first and the mentality that we see all around us today. Would you say that ties in with this existentialism?
That is the result of all of this. Nominalism, empiricism, existentialism create liberalism, and create the denial of not just the nation, but any kind of community. You can't possibly have a community when you have nothing but isolated egos. And that's all existential is. It really all empiricism is. It's a set of these isolated egos that have no intrinsic connection to each other. And today you have psychology where it's even our individualism is falling apart. There's different aspects to our brains, different aspects to how we behave and who we are. So even our individuality is under attack. It dissolves everything it touches. The nation is fundamental because it holds us together. But if you're anomalous, that's about the last thing you could ever hold to. What they can hold to, though, is violence and force. There is a difference between a community and a collective. The community is based on an actual essence of a people, of a nation, that have grown together like a family. A collective is a group of random people thrown together by force and forced to labor, like in the Soviet Union. Community and collective are not just unrelated, they're opposite. Community comes from natural law and absolutes and essences and foundations and all that stuff. Collectives and the ego, and they're closely related, come from its opposite, nihilism and nominalism.
And they'll try and say that the nation comes together by accident, that it's an accident, that it isn't the essence that keeps the nation together, but it's just an accident of birth, that somebody was born in the white race or somebody was born in the black race. Would that fit in with this?
That would fit in precisely. And it's the essence of what we call civic nationalism, which I have to talk about some other time. But civic nationalism essentially is the state. That there is no ethnic foundation. There is no racial foundation or even a religious foundation. The state just encloses a group of people that may or may not be related in any way. And that somehow is a community or a nation. It's laughable. Based on some ideology maybe or some arbitrary moral idea that's imposed from others. It's the opposite of a nation. The nation can never be civic in that sense of the term. A nation is a natural outgrowth. The civic collective is a very artificial outgrowth. But the same people who will deny the nation, they certainly will believe in the international community though, and human rights. Somehow these slip by the nominalist filter. So they believe in absolutes when it suits their interests, but that's really all it is.
Yeah, it's whatever they can make the most use of, I guess. I think we've got one word left that we haven't actually covered yet, and that was teleological. And obviously that fits in with ontological and epistemological, I would guess, because they all feature the word logos in them. So what about teleological?
Well, there's two Greek terms, telos and, of course, logos, as you said. Telos is a reference to an end or a purpose or a goal. It's tightly connected with an essence. If you're a nominalist or an empiricist, you're against any kind of teleology. To believe in teleology, you have to believe in this absolute essence, which is independent of place and time, which is universally true always. Because your essence is something, and this is something actually that existentialists are right on, is that if you, in fact, want to become something, you have to work at it. Freedom is something that you're not born with, you have to fight for. So Aristotle defined the human being as both rational and free. Therefore, and if you're not rational or free, you're not a human being. You're a corpse or you're a plant or you're a cat. And your job as a human being through contemplation and through science and through work and labor is to sharpen those skills to the highest degree possible, to live in intellectual to scientific contemplation. Therefore, is the goal, the telos of human beings. Now, you put that on society, you have different functions. You have teachers and policemen and radio producers. Those are also manifestations, subsets of humanity. We can't be expert in everything. So our reason and freedom are then put to specific areas that create the content of our human nature. What I mentioned with reason and freedom, that's the form of human nature. The content is actually what we do with that. It has to be reason about something. It has to be freedom to do something. That something is our particular function in society. And in our case, really, it's being nationalists and activists to fight degeneracy. That certainly is something. And all of these vocations have a structure, have a goal, have a purpose. Anything with an essence has a purpose. You're not born rational and free. You have to fight to become rational and free. Our telos is to manifest that to the highest possible degree through labor and through struggle and through suffering, usually.
Which we do through becoming nationalists. That's our teleological function, is to be a nationalist.
Unfortunately. I mean, if society were healthy, we'd be something else. But okay. We have to be this because we live in a sick society.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on and explaining all this to me and also to the listeners, Matt. I've really enjoyed that, and I feel I've certainly learned a lot from it. I hope the listeners enjoyed it as well. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.